Accession number 13426, Harold van der Wolf, Reel 3.
Mr. van der Wolf, Reel 3. Now, we were talking about your time with after you joined the 9th Battalion in the camp behind barbed wire in the Ramsey area near Hampshire. And when you joined, you'd not joined as a signaller. You hadn't actually got your signal.
And I was put into a rifle company.
And did you regret that you weren't a signaller at the time?
Oh, yes. Yeah, because signalling became my life, really. I was very enthusiastic about it, and of course my father was absolutely thrilled to think that I'd got into a signal unit. and I suppose being in a specialist platoon, you felt a little bit better than a rifleman. You see what I mean?
Did you ask if you could be transferred into headquarters?
We were told that we would be going into a rifle company because HQ was adequately manned.
There were no vacancies?
No vacancies.
Were you going to be transferred in when there became a vacancy, which there would?
We weren't told that. I mean, I can come on to that.
Right, but we'll leave that there.
Yeah.
Now, you were going to be an invasion battalion.
Yeah.
You were in camp. Did you actually get any training in
saw a landing craft until D-Day morning. Now, apparently, those who had been in the ninth for all the time, they had had training, but of course we were last minute sort of. Even Major Mogg was a last minute intake. He came from Locks and Bucks, I think, and he was quite late coming and was made second in command.
What were your impressions of Mogg before you went into action?
Never saw him before I went into action.
Now, so anything else while you were in the camp at Ramsey that you recall?
No, just my memories of the camp at Ramsey was a month of looking at maps, smoking, eating chocolate, and having a nice, comfortable time. No pressures at all. I mean, the only pressures was that your weapons were examined wet and dry frequently.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when you fire your rifle, you must be dry. But when you're not firing it, it must be wet. In other words, it's oiled. So you use a pull-through, and you use a 4x2 sort of gauze to wipe it clean, and a slightly smaller one with oil on to put oil, a small film of oil. And what used to happen is that the NCO would say, right, I want to see your weapons oiled, or I want to see them dry. And of course you were always being reminded that it was your best friend, because I had a Bren, so that I was put right. I was made a number two on a Bren at that stage.
So that's the loader and the loader, barrel changer.
Barrel changer and all that sort of thing, yeah.
Would you have a rifle as well? I mean, would you...
The number two had a rifle, yeah.
Now, anything else about that period?
No, just that the comradeship was... I mean, I suppose there were 10 of us to a tent, and the comradeship amongst that 10 was absolutely tremendous.
Were you all ex-DCLIs in
your
tent?
We were all from there, yeah. Yeah, we were all pals together.
So at that stage you hadn't integrated?
Not properly, no. No. The only newcomer that was the corporal. And he was a nice, nice chap, but it was obvious that he was not looking forward to it. And if anything, if there was any nervousness instilled into us, it was by him. and couldn't blame him really. He'd been right through North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and he was finally killed in Normandy. You know, so one wonders why anybody should have been made to go through all that, because he must have been years in action.
So he was right to be apprehensive.
So he was right to be apprehensive. Well, and of course he taught us a lot of tricks. I mean, he.
What sort of things? From his experience, did
well,
he, tell
he was saying that if you found some enemy in a trench, and you were getting them to come out to give themselves up, make sure that they didn't have a stick grenade ready to throw at you, you know, as they came out of the trench and all this sort of thing, and also about watching high points for snipers and like church towers and things like that. He was a good corporal. I think I'm fair in saying that he was one of the. He was an NCO who had a desire to protect his blokes, and he tried to tell us, you know, from his experience without any bullshit. Really.
Now, as the month came to, as the invasion time approached, was there any step up in activity, or did it just stay the same?
No, the only activity was that we were issued with French money, and then it was withdrawn again. And quite a few blokes had gambled theirs away. Yeah, and then we were reissued with it. Yeah. And then about 6 days before the invasion, we were taken aboard the ship. We went on to the United States ship called Rapier. And we were there for 6 days.
Because the invasion was delayed, wasn't it?
The invasion was
a couple of days.
One day. Should have been the Monday and it went to Tuesday. But we were put on the boat 6 days in advance. And
what was that like, being stuck on the boat?
Well, my training in psychiatry since has taught me what a psychological thing it was. We weren't allowed on deck during the day. We had to stay down below. Because we were a bit lucky being on an American ship, because they had chocolates and sweets and tobacco.
Was this one of the landing ship infantries, LSIs?
No, this was a cruiser.
Sorry?
Yeah.
A proper cruiser?
Yeah, a proper cruiser called Rapier. I've since tried to find out from the American government what happened to her, and they haven't been able to tell me. I wrote. But
you were saying about the psychological implications. So
hindsight. What they used to do was put us through it in the morning, inspection of rifle dry, inspection of rifle wet, cleaning of your ammunition. You had 50 rounds, and they used to make you polish it.
What, the actual individual rounds?
That's right. And, you know, and it got you actually cheesed off, you know. You were, you know, what a shower this army is, one thing or another. And then at noon, or around about lunchtime, they forgot about you. Nobody bothered you. And so you became bored. You played cards, you wrote letters, you became absolutely bored. And, I mean, in the end, it was roll on, let's get off this B ship. Now, in hindsight, I can see that this was the psychological aspect of it, you know, that these chaps get so fed up and browned off with it all that they'll be only too glad to leave the ship. And we were.
Now, whereabouts were you put on the cruiser? There's not a lot of room on a cruiser.
We're down under, you know, in bulkheads, and we had comfortable bunks. It wasn't hammocks. It was sort of bunks.
What about the American sailors? How did they treat you?
Oh, they were quite all right. I think they were feeling sorry for us, really.
Did the delay bother you, the extra delay, or did you not know it had happened?
No, we knew it happened when it happened, but that the only fear we had was that we used to go up by night and you could see all these ships and that, and we wondered how the enemy didn't know that we were coming. And the fact that we were being delayed, we were afraid that it was going to be, because the weather became quite rough. And we were just worried that it would be either cancelled altogether and it would never happen, or the enemy would know we were coming, you know. And, I think that was the main concern about the delay.
And I forgot to ask, where was the Rapier? That was
in Southampton.
In Southampton Water?
Yeah.
So what happened next then?
Well, the next thing is what we set off, and we...
That'd be on the 5th?
On the night of the 5th, yeah. And as I understand it, we came down the coast and around the Isle of Wight and across that way. But that's only from hearsay.
What do you remember of the trip?
Well, it was perfectly all right until we were put into the landing craft about 5 miles out.
So you weren't seasick at all? Or?
Not until I got into the landing craft, because they're flat bottom.
So how did you get from the Rapier to the landing craft?
It was like a lifeboat. You were put into the thing and then lowered into the water. We didn't have to climb down nets like some of them did. We were fortunate enough to be lowered. And the landing craft we had, being American ones, they had a tarpaulin over them, which didn't give you any protection, but it gave you a feeling of protection. But at least it stopped you from getting sprayed with the water. But even so, we waded in about chest high in water.
Hang on a minute. So you were put in the landing craft, and then you had the 5 miles to sail in.
That's right.
That morning,
and that was rough. That was rough. I mean, flat bottom on a rough sea. I mean, for 3 days afterwards, I was going up and down. I wasn't sick, you see. If you could be sick, then you got it out of your system. I wasn't sick, so for 3 days afterwards, I was, every time I closed my eyes, I was going up and down on this blooming boat.
As long as that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So it just made you feel ill?
That's right. That's right. Out of sorts.
Now, what was the mood in the landing craft as you approached shore?
Quiet, I suppose you could say. Everybody went quiet. But, you see, we were about 2 hours after HR, I suppose. Now, when we arrived on the beach, there were shells whizzing around, but we didn't see any enemy. In fact, if I remember right, the battalion only had one casualty on D-Day, and that was a sergeant who was drowned.
So what was it? Tell me about the landing in as much detail as you will. You were coming in, and then what happened?
Well, then the ramp went down, and on you went. You ran out as fast as you could and up the beach.
But you ran out, but you went into water, didn't you?
Well, deep water. Yeah, deep water. We were given leggings, which came up to your waist to try and keep dry, but... the first blowout shouted back to the rest of us, take them off, because they were splitting and water was getting into them and pulling them down. It was like filling up a balloon. So most of us ripped them off and made our way, got leaking wet. But
how deep was it when you got into it?
It was up to about here, up to about chest.
So yeah. 4 or 5 foot deep?
Oh, yeah, it's quite deep.
Was it still choppy?
Oh, yes, it was very rough.
It's quite deep water to get into.
That's right. That's right.
Did you have trouble getting through the water?
Well, it's not easy because you've got to keep your weapon dry. You know, you had to hold that one up high, and that's right, over your head. And,
what kit did you have with you? Did you have your full
small
pack?
Small pack.
Small pack.
That's right. That's right. And you had 3 days rations.
So the beach was under sporadic shell fire?
That's right, shell fire, but we knew that that it had been cleared of basically of mines and things, you know, that the flares had been out and had followed the first assault course, you know, because I think we followed the 65th Brigade, if I remember, or 69th Brigade, one of those two.
What could you see on the beach? Do you remember now?
Well, dead bodies. And
they hadn't been cleared by
them? No. There were German bodies and British bodies. And, wounded being cared for and that sort of thing.
Was there much activity?
Yeah, I could see a marshal shouting up and down, shouting and waving flags and all that sort of thing. And we were, I went in on Gold Route, well, Gold Beach King Route. Our section lost its way. That by nightfall we were out of touch of our battalion.
So what happened? Can you take me through it? You got onto the beach.
Yeah.
Did you get off the beach quickly?
Yeah, fairly quickly, into some houses, and I remember a brick wall, which was the first sort of protection you had. I mean, it wouldn't have stopped the shell, but it gave you a feeling of protection.
That's just the other side of the beach?
Just the other side of the beach, yeah.
And then what happened there?
Well, we made our way towards Bayeux, really. And then we got bogged down a bit there by enemy fire.
And that's how far did you move towards Bayeux?
I went into Bayeux at D-Day, if I remember rightly.
And what do you remember about that move forward?
Well, because we took Bayeux without a shot. I mean, it was they were.
You were just marching.
So we just walked in. Yeah.
And how many were there with you?
Well, there was 12 in our section.
And were you travelling with your platoon and company, or?
Well, the platoon and company were spread out. Yeah, they were all spread out, but the section kept together, you know.
And you didn't come under fire at that stage?
We came under mortar fire, a mortar attack, but we didn't get any casualties.
How did you feel? This is the first time you'd been under fire, the shell fire on the beach and now the mortar
fire.
Well,
now a bit scared now, you know. Although, it's a funny feeling, really. There was all this firing going on and you'd seen people dead. Up to now you hadn't seen one of your mates killed and you felt, well, you know, it's not going to happen to me. It's a peculiar thing to say, but that's the feeling you had.
So you went to Bayeux.
Yeah.
And how did you get separated from the rest of your
platoon? I don't know. I don't know. I think it was the corporal's map reading.
Is this a confused period in your mind?
Yes, a very confused period, because I know that that evening, as it became dark, we were beside a road, and it was thought that the Germans would attack along the road in the early hours of the morning. And this was the corporal's idea, and I think he frightened us a bit, because he had us digging in and... you know, really panicking.
Slit trenches.
That's right. And standing guard, watching up the road and all this sort of thing. And I think he was panicking. Mind you, he'd been left stranded. I can quite see that he felt he had a lot of responsibility.
They're normal defensive preparations, in a sense. But were there any British troops in front of you, probably?
Well, it turned out that we were in that we had gone a little bit too far forward, that we were in between two lines, really, in the sort of no man's land. We were very lucky, really, that we weren't attacked by either side, you know, because we shouldn't have been where we were.
So although he frightened you, in fairness to him, he had good reason to be apprehensive.
Oh, yes, he did, yeah.
So you dug in.
That's right.
Now, where would you... What sort of pattern of slit trenches would you dig, or would it just be haphazard?
Just haphazard individual things.
And where would the Bren be in a... Would you set it up with a good field of fire?
That's right. We set up the Bren covering the road. But didn't have to use it because the Germans didn't come. It wasn't until 3 days afterwards that we used it.
So... What happened that night you dug in, and then what
That's
happened?
Right. Well, then the next morning we found our battalion.
That's on the 7th?
On the 7th.
And whereabouts were they? Roughly. Just in the area?
Yeah, I suppose we were then by about then getting on for 12 kilometres inland, I suppose. A bit less than that, but 9, perhaps.
So what's the next thing you remember?
Well, the next thing I remember is that it was about the third night. You know, I already said that this young officer was talking about his family and asking me about mine. He's a very friendly sort of chap. But we were on a hedgerow guarding a road, and we put a trip wire, around the corner. And now a trip wire is something that you spread across the road, and if anybody crawls in or walks in, they hit it, and it just goes off with a bang and lets you know that somebody's there. And I remember in the middle of the night, I was acting as number one on the Bren to give me number one a break. And there was a bloke on the pick on the other side of the road, and we were lined onto the corner of the road.
A different road from the other one.
Oh, yes, this is a different area. And there was an almighty bang of this tripwire going off in the middle of the night. I let go of my Bren gun, you know, just spread the road. Matey let go of the Piat gun. And then there was dead silence. So the lieutenant said, who were on duty? Well, this bloke with the Piat and me with the Bren were the actual guard. He said, well, crawl along and see what's happened. And we found a dead cow. And the Piat shot had gone right through, you know. So that we'd lined up ourselves very accurately. But it was a cow that set off this thing. And then I remember a Frenchman coming and saying that there were some Germans in a wood. And so
you don't know the name of the wood?
No idea. And the wood was strafed by mortar fire.
From the battalion?
From the battalion. And then we went into the wood to seek out these Germans. Now, that was quite an experience. Bayonets fixed, going through a wood, because, you know, you didn't know what was going to be behind either tree. Anyway, we went through the wood and found nothing. Came back, and as we came back towards our position, the Germans had moved into our position, and we had to fight to get our positions back.
What do you remember of that action?
Well, all I remember is that we lost a few mates and cleared the Germans out. But what I remember about it, of course, was that the Frenchman was obviously a German collaborator, and it got us out of our lines.
Was that your first time under proper fire?
That's the first time that came under real fire. Yeah, I mean, D-Day itself was mortars and shells and things like that, but no real Germans.
Did the Germans stick in the positions till you got there, or did they evacuate when it became obvious you were going to overrun
them?
Well,
we killed some of them, and the rest of them got the hell out of it, like, really. But it took us about a quarter of an hour, I suppose, to get back into our own, you know, our own position.
What sort of attack plan did they use?
Us? Well, we just went in on our stomachs threw grenades and things into our own trenches, and because it was a sort of ditch place that we were in. We hadn't dug the trenches. It was a sort of ditch along a hedgerow that we were occupying. But
and what caused the casualties amongst your men?
The Germans firing back.
It was small arms fire.
Small arms fire.
That was your first friends.
That's right, seeing your mates killed. Yeah.
Did that change your attitude to the war? Or not to the war, but did it bring it home to you?
Well, yeah, I think that evening, you know, you thought about them and thought about their relatives. And of course, some of them had only been wounded and some killed. But I still didn't feel that it was going to happen to me. You know.
Do
Did you manage to catch the Frenchman, or was that...
Oh, the Frenchman was dealt with. I don't know how, but he was taken away.
Oh, he was still in British hands, then?
Yeah.
So, the next incident, what would that be?
Well, the next incident would be the night of the 13th of June, which is, what, 7 days after D-Day, wasn't it?
Now, this is quite a famous incident, isn't it?
The battle for Lingers, the capture of Lingers. But this was the night before that action. We were sent out to reconnoitre and see what we could find, and we got dug in a cornfield. And all I can remember about it is that I was with my number one in a trench, and our artillery opened up, and the German artillery opened up, and you felt that if you put your hand out of your trench, the shell would take off. That's how close the shell fire. They seemed to be firing sort of straight over your head. Well, then there was silence, and word came through that when we heard the officer's whistle, we were to clamber out and run back to the furthest hedge and get the hell out of it.
To retire from
that's it. That's right. And the whistle went, and I said to my number one, come on, and he didn't move, and he was dead. He was dead beside me. So I put him over my shoulder, Bren gun over the other shoulder, and ran back to where we had to go. And then I took over his number one on the Bren without a number two, so I had to do both jobs.
Did you come under fire as you ran back?
Oh, yes, yes. Shell fire, not short hand stuff, you know, not small arms fire.
Now, what was the situation at Lingev?
Well, then, in the morning, we were told that we were going into action at 10 o'clock, I think.
That's the 13th?
On the 14th.
14th, sorry.
Yeah. And we were, I can remember, we were in a field, and no enemy around, everything quiet, and there was a pump, a water pump, and all of us shaved and washed, and it seemed to be a thing with a British soldier that if he was going into a specific action, he shaved. You know, I think it's recognised as one of the things that we did. But we tidied ourselves up, and it was reminiscent of the First World War, really. You see pictures of blokes coming out of trenches and running across open field. We walked through a cornfield.
The same cornfield?
Yes, towards the village. Now, I'm sure I wasn't in A or C company, because A and C companies had to go and attack a wood somewhere alongside the village. We didn't. We went straight for the village. So I still think I was in D company. We came under heavy artillery fire as we went through the cornfield. And the problem was that if you got a casualty, you fell in the cornfield, you wouldn't be seen. So, I mean, you couldn't stop and tend to a casualty, you had to get on. Well, what we did was, of course, we had our rifles, and the ones with rifles had their bayonets fixed. And what we did, if a casualty went down, we stuck the rifle down with its bayonet and put its helmet on the top with the hope that the stretcher bearers would see him.
Now, why were you walking? Why not run?
Well, because we had to advance. We had an artillery cover which lifted 100 yards every 2 minutes. So we had to keep behind this 2 minute lift off. So that we just walked into, you know, there was no good running.
You'd have run into your own barrage.
Well, that, and we didn't know really what lay ahead of us. I mean, experience has said that if the group commander had known the defensive setup in Lingers, he probably wouldn't have made the action by daylight.
And how far did you have to advance into Lingo? I mean, what sort of no man's land were you crossing? About
half a mile.
Quite a way.
Yeah, quite a way.